Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Now, most people's workplace takes a fair bit of navigating, whether it's the office politics, the leadership dynamic, the kitchen etiquette, not to mention your workload expectations. But what if you're navigating work as a neurodiverse person? What extra challenges does that bring? Well, to talk about this, I'm now joined by Rachel Merriman, who works in the charity sector and who has autism. Brianna Parkins, a writer with the Irish Times, who has ADHD, as does Paddy Fagan, who owns one of my favourite coffee shops in my old haunt of Dublin 8 and who has also been diagnosed with autistic traits. You're all very, very welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to be here.
Listen, before we come to the world of work, there's early childhood. And I want to start there because, and we'll get to it later, because all of your diagnoses were late diagnoses. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to chat to you about your early experiences. Rachel, what were your early years like for you, or you didn't know, but what were sort of your early experiences?
I think there was always a sense of difference. You know, when I was in school, I struggled quite a bit in that environment and didn't really have a word to use. Knew I was quirky, I suppose. That was something that was used quite a bit. And as I kind of got older, I found that I struggled more and more, which eventually ended up with me leaving school early at 15. Just could not cope in that environment, couldn't learn. And a lot of the feedback I got from teachers was that, you know, I wasn't very intelligent. I remember there was a phrase that was used from one teacher saying that, in school, you had to separate the wheat from the chaff, meaning that I was the useless part of the reed. And even as, you know, someone in their 40s, I still remember that.
Of course you do.
You know, that sense of otherness. So it was quite difficult, I think.
And when I think of you, Brianna, I go, whoa, there's one of life's high achievers. How did your, what you later became to learn was ADHD, but how did that manifest to you as a young person when you didn't know? Like, I mean, what were your kind of early childhood experiences?
Yeah, I mean, again, for girls, it's very similar to Rachel there, where you just know you have this internal sense of I'm very different and I'm a bit weird. I don't know why I'm a bit weird. So you just internalize it as I'm not a good person. I can't get things done on time. So my teachers would have said she's very bright, but she doesn't try hard enough, or she's not using her abilities to what the full extent. So essentially going, I sort of fed this lie, and this happens to a lot of people with ADHD or autism, where you're put into gifted and talented classes and you're like, oh, she must be like this genius. And it's like, no, I was hyperlexic because my favorite thing was reading. That was my special interest. So I could just read and I could read to a higher level, which gave the impression that I was gifted. I wasn't. I had ADHD. I was really struggling. If you asked me to do math, I couldn't do it. So I was always sort of pushed into this box of smart but not trying hard enough. And that can really damage you, because my whole life I went through sort of this thought process of like, wow, if I actually just got my stuff together and I was living my life properly, I could achieve anything. And that's not true.
Yeah, you've made me think of my own school reports, a lot of which were, Durbin is very disruptive.
Yeah.
Could do so much better if she applied herself. But Paddy, you're 45 now, but what did your early school reports say about you? And when you look back, you know, what do you reflect on them?
Well, yeah, there was a lot of could do better. And the girls have taken all the best lines, unfortunately, about this. But it's very similar experience.
In what respect?
You feel this otherness that you can't quite explain. You visualize things differently. How you see the world is different. I remember being in the playground in junior infants and thinking the world is not fair. You know, not for anything that had happened to me, but I just had this real sense of inequality that, you know, it's very hard to describe, but just that things weren't fair, that it's very hard to describe it, but it's just a sense of the world and how the world worked. And I was very interested in that. And I was very interested in how people treated each other and things that I don't think your average 4-year-old thinks about.
It's very hard for children to process difference or othering at a very, very young age. Brianna, when you did start, before you went on to do great work, including as a writer, what kind of jobs did you seek out, or what kind of jobs find you mindful of what you now know?
Yeah, I mean, I got a job at 14 in 9 months, which is on the day, which is at the legal age in Australia you can start working. And I think we have more of a culture of you work through high school and definitely university there. We don't get the grants so much. So I did a wide variety of jobs, which look back is very funny. So I was working in a retail shop, was realizing, I was like, why am I not getting on with all these ladies? Like, they tend to be old ladies. I mean, they seemed old to me, but they probably were only in their 40s to 50s. But I was like, this is so old when you're 16, 15, whatever. So I was just not getting on with them. And it was just weird stuff around, like, they said that I wasn't nice because they would pass me in the hallway and I wouldn't look up immediately and say, oh, hi, because I just didn't see them there. So I didn't know I had to be doing those things. And in the end, they put me out the back driving forklifts. And to this day, I still have a forklift license because you never know with journalism where you're going to end up. So I was out the back driving forklifts with all these, like, older men. And I had the best time with, like, Trevor and George and things like that because they were very direct in their communication. They weren't sort of like, oh, you might like to fold those cardigans after lunch. They'd be like, no, you need to move those pallets by 12 p.m. thanks.
Yeah, so because especially with all that non-verbal communication, Rachel, did you consciously or subconsciously seek out work environments that were tailored to your personality or what you thought were your strengths or weaknesses?
Definitely. I mean, I was a musician for all of my 20s, which I know stereotypically most people don't think that, but there's a lot of autistic people that are creative. And so I kind of created my own autism-friendly workplace. And I found that by doing that, I suppose I wasn't challenged in quite the same way as when I went into more conventional job settings. And similar to yourself, Brianna, where it was like, I would go in and I just couldn't quite bridge that social gap between my colleagues. And I know I appeared odd and I was constantly masking and trying to put on a front of normalness, you know? It was definitely always...
So is your brain in conflict with itself trying to... Because you know that there is a, and I'm sort of doing air quotes here, a normalness, but you're aware that you don't maybe correspond to the norms.
Constantly. And so because you're working harder on those kinds of, you know, just navigating that social space, you're exhausted a lot of times. And so you either shut down and, you know, have what's kind of classed as an autistic meltdown, or you just become very kind of introverted in those spaces. And people would think, man, Rachel's really serious, or, you know, she doesn't get our jokes or whatever. Maybe she doesn't get, you know, sarcasm and things like that. Whereas I get all of those things in the right environment. I can flourish, you know?
Yeah. And I just, about Patty, I know you're on your own business, but can you maybe chat us through what some of your earlier roles were?
Yeah.
And again, because you didn't know until much later, how did that inform the employment choices you were making?
I suppose it was like absolutely, like my route through life was bonkers when it came to work. Like I did all sorts of jobs. Did a lot of DJing, like we were talking about the musical aspect. I was in bands. I worked as kitchen porter. I worked a photocopy assistant in an office. And then I was like, I dropped out of college and I did a FOSS course in web design. And then this is kind of very typically neurodiverse route to how I ended up in newspapers was, I'd always been interested in comic books, like the syntax and the punctuation and how people put across words, you know, in a limited space and how they replicated stories in words and pictures. So I'd always been into like really nerdy, you know, grammar and things like that from quite young. And I developed this talent for editing that I didn't know that I thought I didn't do journalism course or anything like that. And I thought that people who...
It's an attention to detail.
Yeah, it's an attention to detail and how to shape a story. And like, I didn't know that that was a job. You know, I didn't know editing was a job. I didn't know sub-editing was a job. I just thought people who could write, like Brianna, who actually writes very well without editorial assistance, but she, you know, that they would just write their piece and then it went into the newspaper and that's how things got done. And I had a friend, basically I was uploading stuff onto a website, onto a music website, and I was kind of tidying it up and fixing the grammar and punctuation and things like this. And I said it to a friend of mine who was working as a sub-editor, and he was like, you are essentially doing my job for free on a voluntary basis. And I was like, well, what do you mean? He's like, I work in the Star and people there get paid like €140 a day to do what you're doing for free. So he was like, would you like, he was very, very good to me. He was like, would you like to come in and do a week's training?
So you find somewhere where you could thrive?
Yeah. So I went in and I did the week's training and it went really well. Like, I didn't know it, but they were using my copy live in the paper. So obviously went well. And then I was just surrounded by lots of, you know, good people there, and they helped me through it. And then I got poached by another paper, and then I just kind of kept on climbing the ranks because there was just something about storytelling and being able to marry kind of strange concepts with words or pictures with words that's so very suitable to the ADHD.
So you find a home without actually searching for it. Brianna, yeah. I wanted to ask you, and you mentioned your experience in retail. What were some of the biggest experiences, you know, or challenges that you faced? Like, were you, you know, you could be brilliant at attention to detail, but clearly front of house kind of wasn't your thing at that time.
Yeah, retail's a funny one, and I've done a few weird jobs. Like, I was a promo girl as well, so that involved, like, I was a Jack Daniels girl, which meant, you know, smiling, walking around with a plate full of shot glasses, being very nice, and getting people to buy them. So any kind of job that requires emotional labor, I struggle with, because I'm not great at what I consider to be lying. So if I am having an interaction with someone who is rude to me, and I'm like, oh, okay, whatever, I'll help you, that is very frustrating and difficult for me to hold that in, instead of just being like, are you well? Do you know what I mean? That would be my stop response. Like, no, that's not happening. So any kind of job that required emotional labor.
Get her off the floor,
yeah,
quick.
Anything that involves sales was difficult for me. That's why I could never do, I think, a proper real job that involves sales, because to me it feels like lying. I was working in a jewellery store at one stage, and we had to sort of guilt men into buying really expensive engagement rings. We had to be like, oh, but she's only worth like $2,000. Is that all she's worth to you? Whereas I'd be like, oh my God, this one's half price and it's $1,000, and she'll never know. This is great. Let me wrap it up for you. So yeah, any job that required kind of me being untruthful or against my values or misaligned, I found difficult to do. But I could do them, and I could mask, and I made great money doing it.
And masking, particularly for women in these conditions, is particularly in their early years, is a big issue. Rachel, years of working, too many years of working in newsrooms, makes me crave a certain amount of background noise. I kind of, you know, whether it's TVs, people talking, whatever, I kind of need that. So I kind of nearly need to create that noise, even when I'm working on my own or writing or something. But what environments or tasks were challenging for you, you know, particularly because sensory issues can arise? So there was anything like that was difficult for you in a work context?
Yeah, I mean, there's the basic things like the actual environment. So say if somebody comes in and they've got really strong aftershave or perfume on, you know, or like I would be similar to Brianna, where I have to see the logic in something and that sense of right and wrong. So, you know, when you have like a lot of needless meetings, you know, and I'm kind of sitting there going,
why?
I want to get back to what I'm doing. Why are we doing this? And then
this is why we need more neurodiverse people.
Yeah.
And just our workplaces.
Loud noises, unexpected noises, you know, things that, you know, you're kind of sitting there.
Kitchen smells?
You. Definitely kitchen smells,
yeah.
For sure. So just a lot of the kind of, and also touch and sensory things. So if someone's too close to me and I feel like they're encroaching on my space, that's the kind of thing that would just throw me.
Yeah. Patty, for you, were the challenges inside or outside of your work environment, you know, because many people who have ADHD or autism spectrum disorders have to manage a lot of anxiety in their life. So were you able to ascertain which is it work, is it inside or outside? Like, I mean, was that a struggle for you to kind of ascertain where the stress was coming from?
I suppose they kind of feed off each other, really. So there might be something happening in your life that affects you, and then that kind of piques the anxiety in you. Because like, there was a long time where I didn't know what it was. I had no idea. But I just knew that the answers I was getting weren't, you know, fulfilling, weren't satisfying me, you know. But like, yeah, there were times, like there was a time when I was cycling into work in my last job, and I could feel a pain in my chest. And I thought I was having a heart attack. Like, I convinced myself I could feel a pain in my arm as well. And I rang my wife, and she was like, oh yeah, go to the doctor. Mm. And I went into hospital, and they ran, you know, checks on me all, you know, all night. They were really, really nice, kept me in all night. And they were like, your heart is absolutely fine, and you stand up really well on the stress test for the running and everything. But is there anything that's really stressing you out now that you kind of may not be aware of that it is, but it is having this effect on you? And yeah, there was a big thing happening in the office at the time, and it was,
and
you know,
that was stressing out. You only got diagnosed last year.
Yeah.
So what was the breakthrough, or how did that come about, and how was that moment for you?
What happened was, I suppose what happened to me when I was working in newspapers, like, newspapers were amazing for me. because like the environment was just dopamine central, you know, like you go in, something new is happening every day, you're working to a timeline,
deadline.
There's a deadline at the end of the day, you could be halfway through the day, everything changes. And like for me,
you could be walking out the door.
But I love that. Do you know what I mean? Because like, especially if it was like the end of the night or something, and say there was like, you know, something big happening in gangland or something like that, and you'd be like, boom, okay, big dopamine hit. Let's do this. Let's do 1, 4, 5, and you know, let's you know, we can get on top of this and we can do it. And I really kind of I absolutely loved that. But what I found really hard was when we went to the shop. We started up the shop, and like say I was doing the cleanup at the start, like there was basically a crew of like one, and Lisa was there, you know, kind of half the time, but
your
it was
wife.
Mostly just me on my own. And I'd be doing the cleanup on my own, and I'd be standing there and I'd be like, okay, I started one thing, and then I'd start another part, and then I'd start another part, and then I'd be like, where am I? Oh my God, I haven't even got this bit finished yet. Okay, finish this bit. And it was this back and forth, and I was like, I'd never encountered that before, because if you're working in an office or whatever, you know, there's a linear approach to an extent, and if it goes off, you still come back to the same line. But it was this situation where I'd have to do one thing, have to do another, and I just couldn't keep track of everything. And I just thought, it was the first time I thought, really, there's something wrong with how I process things, that I can't get through this. You know, there was just, I couldn't put things together, and like I'd end up getting really upset with myself. Mm-hmm. It'd be 6 o'clock in the day, and I wouldn't be home for the kids to start the dinner, because I just had my mind kind of fragmented and I couldn't pull things together and do them in a sequence.
And it'll be very familiar to people. Brianna, when you found out about your diagnosis, was it an aha moment? Was there a relief, or was it a moment of sadness for you?
I think it's
all of the above, perhaps.
You go through grief, and it's grieving the life you could have had.
Had you known?
Had you known, yeah. So if I had the supports as a child, even things like doing my leaving cert, even things like university, which I got through, but was it a great internal personal cost? I had chronic health issues from stress. I just was not a happy person on the inside. So you do have to sort of go through this process of, well, okay. And my parents were quite worried, because they were like, I think they were concerned that I would turn around and be like, this is all your fault. But it wasn't, because it was the 90s. I grew up in a very working class area in Sydney, one of the most underprivileged places you can get really in Australia. So there was no way a doctor or a teacher was going to pick that up. I had a class where kids were routinely throwing chairs at the teacher. Do you know? So the girl a bit anxious in the back reading a book, not paying attention, was never going to get picked up. So that was really interesting to kind of get to this space where I was like, of acceptance about that happened. It didn't get picked up, but this is where I am now. So it was tough. And I think I did almost have burnout or a breakdown, because I had to then realize that the things I thought were personality traits were symptoms. And the way I interacted with the world could be pathologized. And it's part of, you know, a thing that I have, not necessarily little fun quirks about me. So it was really tough coming to grips with that. And I'm still coming to grips with that. And it was like, you know, I owned a brain I didn't have the operating manual to for 30 years. So that's going to take some undoing. And the things that made me do things like stress, pressure, really being under the cosh to get things done, I can work amazingly under pressure, that stopped working for me.
Okay.
And it was like, okay, now I have to figure out new ways to motivate myself that isn't stress and pressure, now that I know I have this thing. It was like all the systems I'd built up over the years now didn't work anymore, because I had this new information.
In light of this new information. And Rachel, there has been a surge in Ireland, but also elsewhere, of adults wanting now to know. And I'm sure many people listening to this conversation will identify with your childhood experiences. And they are now wanting to know, well, are these character traits, these quirks, whatever it is, are they consistent with an autism or an ADHD diagnosis, or somewhere on that spectrum? How did you find out about your diagnosis? And was it a happy reveal, or like Brianna, something of a double-edged sword for you?
Yeah, mine is what I call like a Scooby-Doo reveal. So I have two
Scooby-Doo
children
reveal?
And my oldest child was diagnosed when he was 5. So I knew what autism looked in boys. And when I returned to university, when I was doing my dissertation, because I, like Brianna, have a lot of special interests. So suddenly I'd thrown myself into the world of autism, was educating myself, because a lot of the representations are the, you know, the Rain Man, those really negative, harmful representations. So when I did my dissertation on attitudes to autism in Irish society, I started researching autistic females and a light bulb went off.
Were you kind of looking at the characteristic traits and kind of going, check?
Yeah,
check.
This sounds like someone I know. And then
this is really familiar.
When I did get the diagnosis, it was just huge for me. I mean, I've embraced my autistic identity. Honestly, autism for me is a strength in so many ways, but it is a disability. So not to kind of, you know, disregard that, because for a lot of people, there's so much that we have to struggle and fight against. But definitely for me, it made me have a lot more empathy for myself. I think, like Brianna, I was so hard on myself. Why am I like this? Why can't I change the way that I am? And a lot of the way that I am, it's in my internal life. So it's almost like people want you to prove yourself. Well, no, surely, no, you're a musician. You're so social, you talk. But there's a cost to the way that I am and how I move through
the
world.
You've all spoken about that.
Yeah.
And was that quite unique, obviously, because your primary gaze initially was on your child, and then you find that gaze reflected back at you. Has your life changed much in light of the diagnosis?
Totally. I think, you know, I'm so comfortable in my own skin. I think that I finally, you know, we call it in the autistic community, finding your tribe. I think linking in with, you know, an organization like As I Am. I'm part of a neurodivergent parent group that advocates for children, neurodivergent children. So all of that has just completely made me just so much happier in my own skin. You know, and obviously there are challenges, and a lot of the challenges come from the societal barriers, not necessarily things that we do as autistic people.
Yeah, and I suppose, Patty, actually, people are becoming more aware. It's perhaps why they're seeking diagnoses, or they're seeking kind of maybe answers to it. What kind of, well, you've created your own business, but what kind of accommodations do people need? If we are going to be more aware about neurodiversity, that means the world of work has to change. Yeah. And the same with other equality breakthroughs that we've had. So what's your key requirement?
I just need time on my own sometimes. And, you know, that's like my wife Danielle's been brilliant in this way, especially, you know, recently since the diagnosis, that I just need, I've always had this time that I need to go somewhere and just be on my own and recharge. And
can you do that when you're running a busy business?
Not really. I don't really need to do it during the day. But like, say, Lisa will notice if I'm getting tired, like, you know, because I'm a very animated person. I'm very good at talking to people, and something that's kind of surprised me. But if it gets to the point of the day where I'm drained and my batteries are low, she'll kind of step in and rescue me, and then I'll find something else to do out the back of the shop or something like that, you know.
And what about you, Brianna? What's your sort of key requirement in the world of work now for you?
You know, it's so funny. I was looking up, doing a bit of research into this, as I do, because I write about this and talk about it a lot. Probably too much. Probably people want me to just shut up and go back to doing normal things with journalism. But anyway, so I was reading stuff
You're
about...
You're educating us. You're educating the rest of us.
Well, the way I think about it is, I'm like, I have been accommodating neurotypicals in the workplace my entire career. It's about time you can just turn around now. And so I was reading this stuff, and the Harvard Medical publication was talking about how what best practices is in, you know, for neurodiverse people in the workplace. But there are things that everyone can actually benefit from. It's things like really clear communication that's written. So instead of just firing off or info dumping on someone, send out an email so everyone knows where they are. You know, short meetings that have a point. You know, cubicles back in the workspace. I don't think I'm the only person who dislikes open plan offices. Things, you know, watch out about things like Slack. Slack and those instant messaging tools are a real problem for me. And I had it in a workplace, and luckily they were really nice about it when I explained. And I was like, I can be on Slack and answering you, or I can do my work.
But even people who don't have a disorder, we hate those phenomena as well. Can I ask you, Rachel, you know, because it is a spectrum, you know, and many people who don't have a diagnosis will nevertheless be able to identify with a lot of the challenges. So perhaps it's not as binary. I doubt the brain is as binary as we perhaps have assumed in the past. So what works best for you? And if you were trying to appeal to people to accommodate
yeah,
you, what works?
Slight tweaks, you know, for me, being able to wear noise cancelling earphones in the office at times, short meetings, very similar to Brianna. I think as well, I'm very kind of independent and project focused. So having that kind of trust and autonomy to do my job and, to, you know, instead of the constant check in, a lot of times that can happen in
presenteeism
an office
that
people enjoy. It's part of the social experience. But to me, it's nails on a chalkboard, you know. So things like that, that really don't cost anything. As well, I have a very front facing role. So for me, it's really important that if I'm doing presentations or doing a training, that I'm allowed to have screen time or less screen time, quiet time afterwards. And then the next day, even it to be a bit more chilled out. It's about having that discussion, which is really awkward to explain to people that, you know, hey, I know you met one autistic person and this may have worked for them, but this is what
I need.
Did you
ever feel in the past, Rachel, that you would have been maybe reluctant to disclose?
100%. Because I was afraid it would make me look less competent. But I have a child and I have to live out in the open, because if I don't do that, what am I saying to him? I refuse to kind of be ashamed about it. So yeah, I'm always out in the open about it.
Lots of questions comes in. One, Patty, is how do you go about getting a diagnosis? There's a lot out there about it, but it's hard to know where to go. And that's from a listener, Mary.
Yeah, I suppose start with your GP. I started with my GP, but I had a very understanding GP. And if your GP is not listening to you, you're going to have a very strong feeling. You're not going to want to be diagnosed just for the sake of it, you know. So if you're not getting that feedback from your GP, switch GP and go to another one and keep on trying. It's a very long road to get anywhere with any sort of diagnoses in Ireland. So you just have to be willing to, unfortunately, you have to be willing to kind of stick it out and keep going after something, and you will get there. But it's not easy, but just start with your GP.
Yeah, and for you, Brianna?
I mean, ridiculous. I mean, I was one of the lucky ones, I think I realised before.
Because especially if you're presenting with anxiety or general stress disorder, it might be easy not to pick up.
Oh God,
the whole picture.
I was put on, you know, antidepressants, SSRIs that I didn't need for years, which made me feel terrible. And that was, you know, a real tragedy, is that there are people out there receiving medical treatment that they don't need and it's making them worse. And like, it's very frustrating for me coming from Australia, which has no means a perfect system, but it's free. I never paid for anything. And when I ran out of medication there, I got into a psychiatrist, had to get re-diagnosed, and I got that within 24 hours, and that had taken me 9 months to get in Ireland the same thing. And it was like, there's no reason for it to be this long here. There just isn't the public resources or even the private resources available. So it can be really frustrating for people in Ireland. And sometimes I'm like, look, if you can get to the UK and see someone private, that might be your option if you're really desperate.
And what about Rachel? Look, I mean, obviously you're a parent, but you're also someone with a diagnosis. Like, we hear of parents crying out to get the rest, well, not before they even get to the supports, they just need to get the diagnosis and the support for their children first of all.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously that's a huge part of my life, is advocating for my son and for autistic adults. I've mentioned that as I am. I think that's a huge part of the work that they do, and they do so well. But yeah, it's very tough. We don't get to just enjoy our children being in school. We have to wait for the phone to ring, and there's this constant push-pull every year. Some years we have a great teacher and it goes really well. Other years there's more, you know, of that kind of battle. But definitely I think for me, once I got my diagnosis and it clicked, I'm a member, I have ownership in this community as well, because I think when you're advocating for your child, there's almost this feeling of you're on the back foot, your child is the squeaky wheel, you know, like you were saying, Brianna. So now, yeah, I just kind of go for it every year.
We're getting so many messages in. One person says, one issue I find in the workplace is that some people get it and others just don't, unfortunately. Another said, as listening to these excellent speakers about their experience is like listening to my life story through the radio. I got diagnosed, this listener said, with ADHD at the last March at the age of 40. Every word of what they're saying, I can relate. Thank you for having this conversation. You have no idea of how many people it will help. And I think that is true. I just want to ask you just very quickly before I let you go, to employers or to policymakers, if there was a message you wanted them to take away, what would it be, Patty?
God, I suppose it's kind of a wide thing. I would love people to appreciate the benefit of neurodiverse people. We're pretty amazing.
And well, now we're talking about neurodiversity superpowers.
But so, we can be pretty amazing, you know, like certainly, especially, I don't want to put things down into just the field of creativity, but like even if you look at things like coding, and you know, I know places like Google and Facebook and that, you know, they would probably be actively looking on some level for neurodiverse people.
Yeah, because I wonder, is that Rihanna? Like, I mean, Rihanna, the next thing is going to be that they're going to be actively, just the way you're looking for diversity on boards and everywhere else, they're going to be actively looking for neurodiverse people who can write and drive forklifts.
Yeah. I mean, there's a company in Germany that has already been doing this. They're called the SAP program, and it's been a good success. But just to policymakers, I think the estimation for the UK, I don't know this one for Ireland, is that there's about $1 billion cost to the economy about undiagnosed neurodiversity. So if you can get people diagnosed and getting treatment and getting help, you are going to see that burden be lifted across other mental health services, across other just bodily health services as well, because things tie in if you're not diagnosed. But also, I will say this, neurodiverse people have a harder time being spoofers. So if you want someone in the workplace, there are people who are good at looking like they're doing work, and there's people who are sitting quietly doing the work, and a neurotypical people tend to be the first, and neurodiverse people tend
to
be the second.
So, Rachel, there is a huge potential upside in productivity and no-nonsense workplaces. What would your call or appeal be?
I think the first thing would be stigma is the biggest thing we have to overcome, so educating ourselves. I think having very visible inclusion and diversity programs that also welcome neurodivergent people. I mean, we see it now with people putting their pronouns in their sign-off. You know, it doesn't change the world, but it lets people know that are in the LGBT plus community, this is a safe place where you can be yourself. And I think having that positive representation, having a workplace that says, you know, we are open to neurodivergent applicants and things like that, it starts there, and then embedding that in a policy perspective as well.
Yeah, there's so many messages coming in. I can't even get to them all. All I know is that I'd hire every single one of you in a heartbeat. Brianna Parkins, Rachel Merriman and Paddy Fagan, thank you so much for joining us today. There's great appreciation for the conversation, but that's all we have time for. We'll take a quick break.
Thanks. Email brendan@rte.ie.